Welcome to America's Moderate Voice. Here we cover the latest news on United States policies and actions at home and abroad. We're committed to bring all views together and to bring the facts into the subject. I don't intend to put my own opinion or spin a story one way or another. Here, you decide how you want to interpret the story, to analyze all the facts from all points of views. When we invite guests, we bring in their perspectives, not to persuade your thoughts or opinions, but to have their voices be heard in a transparent and civil discussion. It'll be my job to bring the opposition and differing views on those subjects when opportunity permits. This show is necessary to bring together transparent conversations in the face of a partisan environment. Our country was never meant to be divided. Our union begins with simple conversation understanding. That is why we are here. That is the mission of our show. Our story today begins with the topic of cybersecurity. I've rarely done any episode on this, and I really have the pleasure are bringing back Sherman Tylosky, a podcaster of the show Friends and Fellow Citizens. You'll remember him of our previous episode when we talked about the January 6th insurrection, where he had a unique perspective of being the Capitol Hill on that day. Together, we will talk about cybersecurity, what it means to the United States, what are the challenges and hurdles that it must overcome, and what cybersecurity will mean today and what it will mean in the future. I hope you all enjoy our discussion. And we're back. Thank you for listening to and joining us at America's Moderate Voice. I have the pleasure to welcome back Sherman. Sherman, how are you doing today? I know this is our second conversation. The first one went very well.
I'm doing great, Derek. Thanks so much, Dan, for having me for a second round.
The first round went very well. I really loved our conversation. I'm sure the audience did too. And for the second time, we'll be talking about cybersecurity. What's been going on in the United States in recent months, what the Biden administration is planning on doing, what they may do, and some of your thoughts and opinions on what perhaps they should do to improve or how you see the United States and its environment with cybersecurity.
Absolutely. Let's get right into it.
All right. So one of the first questions I have is, what are the current challenges to the Biden administration in relation to cybersecurity?
Absolutely. I'll split into kind of three categories here. The first is really on threat assessment and response. One of the big issues that's really facing our nation is that when a cyber attack happens, there's not only the cyber aspect where hackers and malign actors steal information and data, but it's also about building that resiliency and also controlling a bit of the psychology aspect. I'll get to that a little bit in our conversation. But the threat assessment part is really critical because when a cyber attack happens in the private sector or on a piece of critical infrastructure, the issue is going to be basically narrowing that time between when the attack happens and the response, narrowed it down to almost instantaneous if you can. Now, this is obviously really challenging, but when we see things like SolarWinds, when we see the Colonial Pipeline, which we might discuss a little bit, these are the things that where it's not even just the threat that happens and then the attack, it's when attack has been in the system for quite a while. And it's not until networks are compromised that we're able to respond to that threat. So the challenge is really being able to create some kind of a national system, perhaps even at a local level too, to help states and localities cope with cyber attacks. But it's really creating that national system and also that strategy and that mechanism so that we have some kind of consistency when it comes to responding to threats, responding to cyber attacks when they happen. The second portion, I would say, is really dealing with the foreign policy aspect, which is how do we hold malign actors accountable? That includes non-state actors, that includes obviously Russia, China, Iran, North Korea, other countries that are engaged in this activity all the time. And the reciprocity aspect is going to be very, very challenging because how do you, first of all, make sure that you know you're targeting the right people, but also how do you use your economic and military strengths to be able to counter these threats and to prevent at least some of these attacks from happening. And it kind of relates a little bit to the first point too, which is knowing, you know, when these threats happen and when these attacks happen so that you're able to respond and reciprocate. And it's also difficult to come up with the reciprocity aspect, because what does it mean to respond to a foreign actor's cyber attack on your critical infrastructure, which obviously has could have very, very big devastating consequences. The third aspect I would also say is really on kind of more of the cyber, what I call cyber education or cyber ed. I don't know if that's a term that's been coined already, but I call it cyber ed, cyber education, which is all about preparing that cyber talent for the next generation. The problem is that we do have quite a bit of innovation, but when you see stats like how we have probably 400,000, 500,000 cyber-related vacancies in the United States, that becomes a real, real challenge, not just of the vacancies, but also how many more vacancies are going to be popping up in the next decade or in the next few decades. How do you prepare that next generation of cyber warriors, so to speak? And not everyone's in tech too. So you have to also take into account that you can't just have a flood of people that all have to do with cyber. I think requires some kind of an interdisciplinary approach where you have people from different fields contributing to the area of cybersecurity. And we might be able to get into that a little bit later in the conversation. But really the cyber ed of preparing those next generations of cyber warriors to be able to defend against threats, respond to cyber attacks, get prepared with the supply chains and all that stuff, that will be kind of the really third main area to deal with. So I would say it's threat assessment and response to cyber attacks is number one. Number two is really the foreign policy, how to respond and prevent the cyber attacks from happening. And number three is on preparing the education part and preparing those next generations of cyber warriors and experts.
That's a great assessment. And there's a couple other things that I was thinking of. One thing I want to respond to sort of that cyber education, and it's something that I've heard of. It's something that I've heard many people that's a concern for. You know, we don't have that many students that are excited for science, math. Like there's been a strong promotion of STEM the last few years. Well, I haven't seen such a huge rise in like the STEM field. And you're still seeing that constant promotion. And obviously cybersecurity goes into that field. Knowing how to computer science, a lot of people are saying it, like, it's very hard. Not everyone's tech-like. It doesn't seem like it's inherently in the American education to focus on computer work, on computer education. So I do see that as being a big issue when it's coming to sort of replace this current generation of cyber workers. Like you said, with the vacancies, we have such 400,000, 500,000 vacancies, and those are opportunities for jobs. Those are opportunities for people to find work. And it's a good thing. However, it's a long educational technical training process that could be something that prevents people from wanting to do. And I think that is a big concern. There's a hole in that education. The first part you said was threat assessment or acknowledging like who is the hacker or responding to that, if I like to add. I think it's very hard because it's very hard to target someone on a computer. You know, it's not like regular warfare where you can bomb a territory, you know where a fort is, you know where people are hiding. Being on a computer, this is what professors or people in foreign policy that I've spoken to, it's the next phase of warfare.
Right.
Warfare on the digital scale where it's easily to be mobile. Like you can easily move around. Like I can hack from this computer here in New York and easily be on a flight to another country and hack somewhere else. Or I don't have to even really move, but it's so hard to respond in a physical sense, let alone now digitizing everything. You have access to the entire internet, depending on your skill level as a hacker. So there is a lot of concerns and challenges. I do see that the Biden administration and, well, even future American administrations maybe have to face.
Absolutely. And you bring up some really good points there about the change in the terrain of warfare that we're dealing with. I do also emphasize that this really is a multi-administration, multi-Congress issue and something that is going to take quite a bit of time. Although I think what we're trying to look for is leadership, you know, knowing where that path forward is, because with regards to technical aspects, you know, there are things that you can do in various different levels in different organizations, in the private sector, especially because they obviously get a lot of that tech talent. The real question is, how do you get multiple administrations and multiple congresses to get more of these tech people working for the public sector? Because that's also a bit of a challenge when you have people drawn to the private sector for the pay and for the benefits and everything, whereas the public sector, it can be kind of tricky. And we're still trying to figure out what that role is for young professionals and for private sectors, because the private sector also has its own concerns about working with the government, especially when it comes to data sharing, liabilities, and other supply chain related issues that could come up, and they could be really, really scared with being working with the federal government on these issues. They might be scared to, especially for shareholders. If shareholders find out that this company has been breached, it's not only an embarrassment, but it can also cost the, you know, their market value and other numbers. So it all kind of ties in with what I was saying earlier about how it's a very multidisciplinary approach, because you're dealing with economics, you're dealing with tech, and education, I would say psychology, but also having that policy and that leadership, which we're looking for. And that's what the Biden administration has to do. They have to show that America is not going to be reactive anymore to cyber. We are going to be proactive, have people at the top who are going to say, this is the direction of this of nation. We're going to put together maybe a national cyber strategy. We're going to have people from different sectors to come together and say, we are committed to ensuring that the United States is that top competitor and that top nation for cyber. And we also need people to reassure the American people that when a cyber attack happens, especially when it's on critical infrastructure, people's lives and safety are not going to be compromised, and that there is going to be some kind of mechanism to support people when an attack happens, because we know that it's going to happen. It's just more of how do you respond to that? And how do you make sure that you have some kind of confidence and faith in our cyber infrastructure?
No, you're completely correct. And one thing I also want to add is, not only do you need to have consecutive administrations, congressional, executive, to be like on board with this, but you need to have them like putting this on a priority.
Right.
You don't want an administration after, let's say, three administrations that put cybersecurity on top priority to no longer focus on it, and that has our vulnerability there. We're vulnerable at that point. So this needs to be something that's a clear message that the United States is moving forward with. And it's something that we're going to see that's a top priority for the next few decades. It's something that's going to be where I see has to be consistent through for the next consecutive administrations.
If I could just add one quick thing, I would also add that we need to have this kind of sort of staggered leadership. What I mean by that is to not depend on one leader to only last one administration or one Congress. We need to have someone who can work with the White House or the executive branch and, you know, the legislative branch, maybe be confirmed, you know, obviously by the Senate. Obviously the National Cyber Director is one of those new positions that will be confirmed by the Senate. If we can have that kind of consistency, but also that ability to have some sort of fresh talent in certain leadership roles, and perhaps really the execution part of these leadership strategy or the cyber strategy, that would also be a big help too.
So we talked a lot about the long-term goals, what we're needing to see, the challenges. But my next question is, what do you think of the past attacks? And a lot of the past attacks that we've seen have come from hackers from like Russia, Iran, China. But one of the more ones that really caught the headlines were like SolarWind, that kind of hacks on private companies. So what are your thoughts on these past attacks?
Let's take SolarWind as an example. I was very much interested in one of the hearings. I think actually there was a Senate one and a House one. I think Senate Intel did one, and the House Homeland Security / House Oversight did another one about SolarWinds. They had a Microsoft guy, they had some other folks from SolarWinds and everything. What I thought was very interesting is when you look back at the SolarWinds attack, you notice that these hackers were infiltrating our system for months before anyone found out. And this is really, really scary because you don't know what is compromised. You know, they put some official stats there that X number of agencies or bureaus were infiltrated. Well, what is the extent of that? And a lot of that could be just classified information. So in the public domain, we're not going to find out. But on a much larger scale, it goes back to what I was saying earlier, which is being able to have that rapid response threat assessment. You know, why does it take that long for a company to realize that it's been infiltrated? And it's not, and I'm not a tech person myself, right, in terms of the technical policy or the technical little details and everything, but I do know that there are ways that we can work together. When I say we, as in, you know, the public sector and the private sector, there are ways in which we can have some kind of confidence by just being more transparent. I think what the problem with SolarWinds is when it was breached, you know, SolarWinds kind of also got a bit of too much of the brunt, in my opinion, because it wasn't just SolarWinds. It was all these, it was the supply chain aspect. The fact that SolarWinds was working with a number of different platforms, and it just kind of is branded as such. And you know, I'm not saying that they're completely off the hook. I'm just saying when we label some of these attacks, we all have to make sure that it is a very, very encompassing issue and that it takes a multifaceted approach and multiple different agencies and organizations to come together. Now, that being said, I do think also that SolarWinds could have done a better job of working closely with the government. Now, problem is nowadays we're seeing these attacks, right? And we seem like we're kind of going in circles a little bit. We're kind of seeing how the private sector is voicing the same kinds of concerns about liability, how the fact that they don't want to be sued by other companies or other folks, and maybe even the government, right? But then the public sector is saying, well, you got to tell us when these attacks are happening because we need to respond. We have CISA, the agency that is very much responsible for our critical infrastructure. We have these folks who want to be able to respond and help you guys. But that gap between the public sector and the private sector on trust and on this mutual work is still quite large. We need to close that gap eventually. SolarWinds is certainly not going to be the last one. Obviously, I mentioned Colonial Pipeline. These are just kind of two of the most recent ones. There's been obviously other ones of large scale, small scale. If you even go back almost, I believe it's 7 years ago now, 2015 OPM hack that exposed so many people's private accounts and information registered with the federal government. I mean, think about the consequences of that when a foreign intelligence agency can literally know the information, almost everything about someone and about their career and how they can exploit that. So when we look back at SolarWinds and we look back at some of these attacks that have happened in the last several years or so, let's have those conversations and those tough conversations between those two sectors and amongst people within the general public about the need to be transparent, about the need to not live in to be in a society where you don't have to sue each other every single time there's something a little wrong goes fine. There are times when we need to think about the larger picture and realize that things are more we always say that everything's interconnected. In fact, it seems like every time we say that, we find something that makes us realize we're actually even more interconnected than we might ever feel before.
It's a very interesting take, and I really like how you brought up the public view of this when it's happening to private companies, when a lot of private companies have hold on individual person's data or information. But a lot of times we're sort of voluntary when we give that data. Not all, but there's sometimes in some instances where we want to put our private stuff like on a computer or whatever, or on a certain platform. But I'm very curious on, so there's some support there. So you intern on the Hill for Congress.
Right.
How do you see Congress when it comes to the subject of cybersecurity in any shape or form or just generally? Is there strong support for building cybersecurity? Is there differences? Is like Congress, are they unified behind this or is there some division? Is it politics that's disrupting a unified measure for the United States? How do you see this?
Sure. I think in large part, cyber is a new issue for Congress. And I'd say for the most part, you know, both parties are on board that we are not doing enough on cyber. We're not building enough of that talent. I mentioned earlier about cyber ed, right? Then there's the idea that when attack like SolarWinds happens and we realize that the federal government was not notified, both parties are going to get very incensed and they're going to be very, very concerned about why this keeps happening. And they've thrown around some ideas for sure about liabilities, but for some reason, there's a bit of a logjam here. And my assumption or my thinking is that because there's been a lot of debate about things like big tech, about antitrust, and about data privacy, I'm concerned that some of that is kind of colliding with this larger part of dealing with cybersecurity. Because whether or not people like, you know, what Facebook does or what Amazon does, these are huge companies. And by the way, I'm just saying, I'm leaving out the discussion about antitrust and all that. I'm not an expert on that. And that's certainly something to be explored. But I'm just saying that when you have these large companies who have all this data, have this enormous power, it's a little crazy to just kind of distance yourself and say, well, I don't like big tech companies. I don't like these folks, so I'm just not going to deal with them, or I'm just going to yell at them all the time. It doesn't work that way, because then you're kind of just disconnecting yourself from that larger problem of how do you build resiliency across the system. And the private companies just want to know what do you guys want to do? They're kind of looking at Congress and say, tell us what this legislation is going to do, and we will do what we can. We have our own opinions about how far it goes, and maybe the liability aspect, as I mentioned, the cooperation. But they just need to, I think they just need to know what's going on, and they need to be clear about this leadership aspect. Goes back to what I was saying earlier also, which is the leadership part. There's every single senator, every single representative is concerned about cybersecurity. Don't get me wrong, but who is actually spearheading this? Is it the speaker? Is it the chair of the House Homeland Security Committee, Benny Thompson from Mississippi? I'm just as an example, not meaning to pick on him personally, but it's just, you know, we need to have some kind of concise leadership and understand what the priorities of this Congress is. And we need some kind of clarity from both parties too, right? Because both parties have some kind of say in what cyber should be like and what they want to do. And largely speaking, going back to what I was saying, it is a bipartisan issue, but we're not seeing the clear road ahead. We're kind of, it seems like every single committee or every member or representative maybe wants to go their own way or have their own little niche cyber ecosystem, so to speak. But to connect those with that larger grand strategy, that larger national cyber strategy, is going to be the real challenge here.
For Congress's sake, it's not a political issue, what we're seeing. Based on how I'm interpreting what you said, it's not a political issue. There's a lack of leadership. So there's a lot of ideas being thrown around.
Right.
A lot of different committees that have their own thoughts, have their own opinions, have their own
right.
way of wanting to deal with cybersecurity. But there isn't leadership.
Right. And the reason why I also bring that up is because cyber is such an encompassing topic that every single government agency in the executive branch or in every single committee in the legislative branch, they all claim that they do cybersecurity. You know, you can make a huge case about how the Homeland Security Committees, there's a Senate and a House counterpart, they're the ones who should be the leading ones on cybersecurity, because it deals with Homeland Security and they have oversight on CISA, on DHS. But then you have House oversight, let's just say. Oversight has the broadest jurisdiction of any committee in Congress, because they, as the name suggests, right, they basically can go to any agency and say, we want an investigation on this, we want to look into this issue. And then they often claim that they're the ones who should be looking at cybersecurity, because it does encompass every single government agency. But then you have like party leadership, and then you've got Senate Intel or House Intel saying, well, no, because maybe Intel, on the Intel side, we should be the ones helping with this with the cyber issue, because we're on the front lines, or we conduct oversight on people who are on the front lines of cyber. And so maybe we should be taking some kind of leadership role. So you see how cyber, because of the nature of what it entails, I think it's a little different from foreign policy, because I know foreign policy is also a broad subject too. Mm-hmm. The reason why cyber is a bit more sophisticated is because it really does cross this technical and policy and leadership realm, which I don't see as it, I think it's broader than foreign policy, let's just say, because if you think foreign policy, you can maybe think of foreign relations or ways and means on the House side. But cyber is, again, still a new subject. There's no clear leader or person or committee that's saying that's being entrusted with this cyber leadership. There needs to be, I think in the end, it's going to have to go down to maybe the speaker or the minority leader working together. And of course, the president of the United States also, and of course, the Senate leadership too. The top leaders, the buck stops there when it comes to the cyber, I would say.
I guess as a default, I would agree that you should just give it to the House Speaker, Minority Leader, and President, like as coordinations on who should be leading this. Mm-hmm. But I don't know about you, but I wouldn't be surprised if in the next few years, or maybe even later, depending, sometimes Congress runs a little slow, that there may be a committee just on cybersecurity or on the digital framework. Like there may be a committee created just based on that, perhaps because of the reasons you laid out before us, that different committees feel that it's within their jurisdiction to do so. And that perhaps as we evolve more into a more technical world, more tech-savvy world, as we become more dependent on cyber life or just using computers, we may need just committees just solely on that. I personally wouldn't be surprised. I don't know about you.
Sure. Well, and this is a good segue into the Cyberspace Solarian Commission, which is a commission created not too long ago. I believe it was started in the for fiscal year 2019. It was established in the John McCain NDAA, created every single year, usually passes in a huge bipartisan manner. But what they did was that they put together a group of commissions, about a dozen commissioners from different backgrounds, some from the public sector, the others, the co-chair was Mike Gallagher of Wisconsin, Republican, and the independent Senator Angus King, who was the chair of this commission. And these two led a commission that would look into some issues with regards to our cyber strategy, but also put out over 80 recommendations to implement the strategy. And many of those have been implemented into law already, including, say, the National Cyber Director and some other issues to deal with. And you mentioned the committee, and they do propose this kind of committee where you have a House and a Senate committee dealing with cyber. You know, it really is an interesting topic to look at. I don't think anyone really knows what the feasibility is going to be like, because you also have to add in the politics to it, right? Because even if it was bipartisan, say equal members, right? You know, there will be debates about who gets to run that, because cyber is such a fast-paced issue. So maybe some people will argue that, no, you have to go by the seniority sort of system, which is kind of in place already, where the higher up, you know, the better chance you're going to land a top committee position. But maybe some other people are going to argue, saying, well, you need some more freshman members, kind of get them experience too. That's the same kind of thing with the House Homeland Security Committee as an example. You have a lot of freshman members, at least on the Republican side. So there's a lot of discussion about what those committees could look like, and just being concerned of making sure that you don't have a committee stepping on the toes of another. And this is going to be a really critical aspect, which is why I still believe, even if you were to create a House and a Senate committee on cyber, you still need to, at the end, when you get past the little skirmishes about potential skirmishes about who gets what and what who does what, it is still the buck stops at the top. And that's when the Speaker and the House Minority Leader on the Senate side, the majority and the minority leaders, they need to be the ones to take charge and say, this is our chamber, this is the way we're going to go. And they need to be able to kind of steer where this committee goes and where all the other committees go with regards to cybersecurity.
Well, yeah, definitely leadership has to be a key role here. And that is going to be a little tricky for what you were mentioning towards the end, was do we keep some of our older members who have more experience in this, more experience in the policy, to take much of the focus here, or get some of the freshmen so that the ones that are supposed to be like the next generation in Congress, we get them to take more of a role in here, because we're going to need them for the next 30 years. If think of it as if they're going to have a congressional career.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So definitely leadership is something that we're going to have to fix for ourselves, for domestic politics and the policy here. And now I kind of want to shift it a bit now. Want to leave Congress, the realm of Congress, and move towards more of a security, a national security or foreign policy front. And that is, first, we analyze who are the top rivals in cybersecurity. So who do you think out in the world, who are our top rivals when it comes to cybersecurity?
Sure. Well, the first one that I think everyone is very familiar with is Russia. Russia is economically a lot of trouble. And I think that's one of the reasons why they are probably investing more in cyber, because it's not like it levels the playing field. That's not the right term. But what it does is that it kind of goes above the already pretty dire, like, demographic issues and economic issues that Russia's going through. And they're able to use that as their kind of weapon and their ability to control the narrative on cyber, not just in the United States, but perhaps around the world. And obviously they also do it for influence operations to try to spread propaganda and all that. And while there are many kind of origins of kind of where this is all kind of coming from, one incident that I do think everyone should remember is that in 2007, Estonia, which is a Baltic country right next to Russia, was essentially bombarded with cyber attacks from Russia, because there was a disagreement on went on to remove a Soviet era statue, a memorial of some kind. I'm not even joking. This is really how crazy it was. And while it feels a bit of a while ago in 2007, but the Estonian government's websites were compromised. And you imagine now, a tiny country like Estonia, the reason why they're so committed to cyber is partly because of that incident, and because they understand full-heartedly this impact of propaganda, of disinformation, and of the cyber attacks are coming from Russia. So Russia still is, even though I use this as an example on Russia attacking a much smaller country, but you can imagine now, fast forward about 14 years later, how interconnected we are now, and Russia is still at it. They still have a lot of these folks who work for the GRU or the SVR, the kinds of folks who are obviously very close to President Putin and his regime, to try and establish themselves as that post-Soviet, you know, Grand Russia. Which he obviously witnessed himself as an intelligence officer. He's witnessed the collapse of the Soviet Union, and I believe that he's using cyber as one of those tools to try to get Russia back into the game. So Russia is definitely one. Obviously, the second I would say is China. China is understands that it has some other issues to deal with too. I mentioned the demographics issue in Russia. There's like low birth rate and all that. There's also the economic the hardship that they're going through. China also, I think, recognizes this as an opportunity for them to exploit and take advantage of the United States. And they do it through stealing intellectual property. They do it, obviously, through hacking, through disinformation campaigns, too. And because they are, I would say, the much larger malign power that we're dealing with, I would say China really should be kind of number one, because of the fact that they have a lot more of these prospects of being able to have these sort of cyber attacks on the United States, to have those capabilities to develop and to grow and to affect our allies too. Imagine our East Asian allies who have to cope with China, probably the worst neighbor you've ever imagined in the history of geopolitics. But they have to deal with this all the time. And so if we don't understand the cyber threat and the cyber capabilities that China is going to pose, despite a lot of rhetoric that we've seen hearing from Russia, in the long term, it's not going to end very well for us. And so we need to keep our eyes on the ball of these two rivals, especially on China. But there's also other rivals too. I would say non-state actors as well, when you think of what ISIS was trying to do with regards to their propaganda videos, using Twitter as a means to promote their message, that it is only the beginning of what we're going to be able to see. Imagine what's going to happen when we have deep fakes that are going to be more prevalent, AI. So many things are going to not only change the cyber terrain, but also affect our faith in technology, maybe our faith in political systems. If it gets to that point, it's already happening. And so I would say these rivals, Russia, China, non-state actors, some other players too, you know, Iran, I believe, is also involved as well. North Korea is trying to do the same, probably not to the scale of what Russia and China are doing, but we need to absolutely, if we're going to put together national cyber strategy, we would absolutely be fools to not include Russia and China, and to say specifically that these two powers, notably China, are ramping up their cyber capabilities. And if we don't address this right away, we're going to have a huge problem going into the future.
Well, so we hear all this news of Russian hacks from China, Iran, non-state actors. I mean, but I don't hear anything from the United States, any responses, nothing as strong. It always goes back to diplomacy, but we don't really see much of retaliation. But a lot of times I would hear, especially in the Biden administration, a lot of their concerns is that our cyber infrastructure is weak or it's not as strong. In your opinion, can we compete with our rivals today, or are we on track to be able to compete with them on the cyber world?
At this trajectory, we have the innovation, but we don't have the means to really materialize that innovation as much as we can. I don't see, you know, Russia, China, Iran having really anything near the kinds of technological innovation, creativity that we have. There really is something unique about the United States in that it is the powerhouse of technological innovation. The problem is really getting from innovation to materialization and using that to our benefit. Kind of going back to what we were saying about the cyber talent aspect, the cyber education part, goes back to the critical infrastructure part, giving some kind of trust in that the public sector and the private sector can and will work together when an emergency happens. These are the kind of the foundational blocks. And if I could really point to something that relates to your question, answers your question, it's really this public-private partnership aspect. I know I mentioned, touched upon this a little bit earlier. I believe that the barrier of innovation in part is because we have quite a bit of an outdated, so public sector, private sector contractual relationship, in the sense that, well, the public sector world is going to be in our kind of little world, and we just need you guys to handle admin, and you guys, hopefully you guys will share with us some data, and we'll be able to figure this out. I don't think that's really the way to go, because that's more reactive, right? When something bad happens, then both sides have to kind of go back and forth about who's responsible and who's sharing data, who isn't sharing data. What thing needs to happen is there needs to be an elevated relationship between the public sector and the private sector, in part because critical infrastructure is owned by 85 to 90% of critical infrastructure is owned by the private sector. So when we see such a statistic, we need to elevate that relationship so that it is pretty much seamless kind of cooperation when needed. Obviously, you don't need to have it 24/7 on every single aspect of data and every single transaction. But in those circumstances, when you're able to detect threats, respond to attacks, and you can do so with much less bureaucracy, more trust between different entities, whether it's between Google and the Pentagon or Amazon and the Cyber Command, when you have the sort of trust that you've built and you've had a system in place where you don't just have, you're just signing off contracts, you're literally working together, maybe even in the same physical space, and you're detecting these threats and you're working seamlessly between all levels of government and all levels of the private sector, that's when you can really get to a point where you can have some kind of national resiliency and you can start protecting in critical infrastructure maybe even faster. But we're still a little bit behind on that. And that's also going to be perhaps very persuasive for those who want to bring their talent, their cyber talent, and they want to kind of showcase it, make a lot of money too, right? If you're able to make a lot of money and showcase it to the world, and you have the big customers, like the big tech names and the US government, well, there you go. Then you have an opportunity to showcase that talent. And largely speaking, we're able to get to a point where we can use that talent and project that onto a national security stage and a homeland security stage, and also be able to project that through our foreign policy too.
Interesting. Now, I want to connect to your explanation right now to something you mentioned before, which was a lot of people who are tech savvy or specialize in IT or in cyber world.
Right.
A lot of them tend to go towards the private sector. There's yes. less or maybe not as much of an incentive to work for the government to work right. in the public sector, which then makes me think of, was it Biden's May 12th executive order on cybersecurity? This also in relation to the American Jobs Plan, where if I have it here, Biden's basically asking for investments, but of billions of dollars to ramp up our security. Mm-hmm. So for example, like grid resilience, making sure our infrastructure grid is stronger. He is devoting $2 billion to support microgrids and distributed energy infrastructure grid resilience in areas where there are high risk for power outages or there's critical infrastructure that's needed for repairment. So I do see some stuff of the public sector sort of growing in this area, but a lot of it is where there's incident response activities. So improving security monitoring, where he's giving $650 million to the Cybersecurity Information Security Agency. So a lot of it is just testing out or improving quick responses. So we do see that happening. However, it may not come as soon as we want it to. And I don't know, do you see time relatively on our side? Can we wait a little longer to improve quality, or is this something that we need to get the best thing out right now and not wait for the next attack?
Absolutely. I mean, I would say we need to start right away. You know, time is a cost, you know, and especially in economics terms, maybe just because I took an economics class. So I have the credibility to say that out for the record, but time is a cost. Mm-hmm. And when you don't factor time into, you know, your strategy in a national cyber strategy or some kind of cyber leadership, then I don't think that's any kind of leadership whatsoever, because you're not prioritizing this, right? Because everyone says, you know, something has to be priority, it has to be done now or like in the near future, right? And so when you incorporate that time aspect, this is going to be very, very important for cyber. I do think, though, that when it comes to some of those larger structural issues, like I mentioned earlier about cyber ed, obviously we can't be, you know, in a dreamland and hope that it's going to happen tomorrow, right? Mm-hmm. But we can start right away. I would also, I'd like to add something where if we want to accelerate this idea that we need to have a cyber ed culture, so to speak, let's have the federal government start also empowering the state and local governments too, because they also have a role as well. You know, hackers are not going to just hack into the federal government. They're going to hack anywhere they want. They're going to hack the universities. They're going to hack research centers. I've mentioned private companies too, obviously. They're going to go after that. And they're not only going to go after one company, they're going to find the companies or the organizations that have nodes with plenty of other different organizations, because then it makes it a lot easier for them. So we also need to include the local and state governments. I think they can have a very, very big role. They can have, I don't think they need to necessarily come up with, you know, the national cyber strategy, but they can say, and it's kind of also plays into local and state politics too, they can say, look, the state of whatever, so let's take New York, right? In Albany, they can say, in New York, we know that we have these particular firms that, you know, maybe are in New York City now or in other parts of New York State. We want to bring more, let's say more talent to Syracuse, because we want to grow that department. So the computer science department, we want more researchers there. The state and local levels of government are going to understand and going to want to grow their cyber talent anyway. So why not include them as part of our national conversation and just have the federal government say, okay, here's the overall roadmap. Then give the states, while they're working with CISA and others of those big companies, have the state and local governments also understand, okay, what's the best way to respond to a cyber attack if it hits, you know, the state of New York? You know, what do local governments do? What's the protocol to respond to those? And how can local governments work with the state governments on finding a way to coordinate cyber response so that if something were to happen, that everyone kind of knows what to do? So I also do think that when it comes to time, we can't just count on the federal government, obviously, to take on the cyber role only and just say, okay, here's the way to go. Everyone listen to us, Simon Says sort of thing. Mm-hmm. We need to have the federal government allow the sort of federalism to take place and allow the state and local governments to be incentivized and interested in this larger cyber leadership trajectory that the United States should be on. And it will also obviously give a lot of, it's going to benefit at the local level. I often, when I go on to other shows, I talk about the importance of having people get involved in local politics too, because that really, there's going to be a lot more influence, more tangible influence you're going to see out on the streets than if you were to try and lobby the federal government. But I also do think that when we bring the cyber interest and cyber knowledge into our local communities, we're going to be able to know those people who enter those fields and be able to know that they are part of a larger strategy for the United States to be that top leader. And we don't need to count on every single thing from Washington, D.C. So I want to say, if we're going to prioritize time, let's go full blast on that, on the local, state, national level, university, public schools, private schools, public, private companies, you name it. Let's all find our niches and find our roles in this grander cyber strategy that we're hoping to look for from the Biden administration and from future generations and future administrations to come.
I really much enjoy that explanation there. And you kind of answered a little bit of my final question, which was, what do you think the Biden administration should do to improve our systems? Now, you pretty much touched on sort of a ground up basis in which establish an educational promotion of this. So hopefully that can help with our systems long term by incentivizing innovation, getting more people with more creative talents to come and join this field. So I have more of a long-term view right now based on that answer. But is there anything else that you believe that the current administration should do in order to improve our systems, in order to compete against our rivals, perhaps in that transformation into getting the innovation, the ideas into a more material aspect?
Absolutely. Well, I'll start with the National Cyber Director. I mentioned that a little bit earlier. What's important about the National Cyber Director position, in my view, is that this individual is going to have to mediate a lot of disputes on who is in charge of cybersecurity. Yeah. As I mentioned earlier, I mentioned committees and even executive agencies all claim that they do cyber. And it's not that they're wrong. It's that the problem is that you need a leader to say, okay, what is the actual goal of this administration when it comes to what the cyber environment that we want to create here in America? And the National Cyber Director nominee, Chris Inglis, I think he's a great nominee because he comes from the Cyberspace Solarium Commission. He has a lot of experience working with lawmakers and the private sector. He could really be quite a an influential leader. And I know there's not a whole lot of news and buzz about the national side director. That probably is going to change at some point when we continue to immerse ourselves in the cyber world that we're living in. But the Biden administration really has to use the national cyber director position as an advantage and show that this will be the first time that we will have a clear vision of what cybersecurity policy is going to look like in the Biden administration and perhaps in the Congress too, when it comes to legislation that to support those cyber policy recommendations and policies. And then on a much larger scale, also, I hope that the National Cyber Director will be the one to also be that main White House liaison between the federal government and federal government and the states and the localities. Because when I think, imagine when the governors meet with this National Cyber Director, think of the message that sends. It shows that we are very much all in this together in terms of a national mission. And the governors and the other leaders, perhaps, I don't think it's just the governors, they can meet with the National Cyber Director should meet with as many state and local politicians and leaders as possible. But what this does is it incentivizes some kind of inclusivity when it comes to everyone playing some kind of role in cyber. There's a number of initiatives that they can do. They can have like a round table meeting of some kind about cyber hygiene, right? Like the best way to make sure that you might not want to click on that email that says you want $10 million, right? This probably didn't happen to you. Just things like that. You know, those kinds of initiatives. The White House, generally speaking, can have these sort of initiatives when it comes to anything, but they can do something along the lines of putting together programs, working with governors and leaders from across the country in promoting cyber education, getting kids involved in, like, say, scholarship programs, offering those can be very, very important, especially bringing minority groups and people who want to be part of this larger cyber realm who may not have had this opportunity before. So when you grow the pie, when the White House National Cyber Director, obviously with direction of the president, when they can go out and say, this is a new era for American cyber. American cyber is no longer going to be just associated with Facebook or with Google or with the big tech companies. This is going to be all about us and about how we can work together across parties. We can have our differences and everything in different venues, but we can come together and realize that this is an issue that's bigger than any one of us. And they can make a priority saying that the National Cyber Director, in coordination with CISA or with Congress and with other agencies, they are there to be more transparent, to learn from every single incident, every single cyber attack that happens, or learning about the tactics, I mentioned earlier about foreign policy, learning more about how these foreign adversaries use a cyber as their ways to gain political power across the world. So it's that kind of leadership, that inclusivity aspect, so to speak, to include a diverse group of professionals, including professionals from various different sectors, having that interdisciplinary approach rather than technical approach to cyber. Those are the kinds of things that the Biden administration has to do. And the National Cyber Director and other leaders can start with that right away. As soon as Mr. Inglis is confirmed, and I believe he will, because I think he gets quite a bit of bipartisan support at this time, when he gets confirmed, he's going to have a lot of responsibilities waiting for him. It's a new position. There's a lot of new challenges that have to be figured out. But if we can have the right kinds of people, right kinds of leaders who can, who don't micromanage, but who are actually the ones who can envision how cyber works in the year 2030, 2040, 2050, perhaps, that's when we can move to a point where America can be a leader in cyber and can remain that top leader and ensure that no country, no foreign adversary can top that position whatsoever.
Thank you very much for the explanation, and what you think the Biden administration should do to improve our systems. So for final thoughts, we have just sort of a recap. You laid out the reasons to why we have current challenges in the Biden administration, what these past attacks have meant, our rivals, what improvements we should do. And I think one of the biggest things we should take away from here is that, one, this is not a political issue. This is something that we need to find leadership and to have a clear message on what we do. That's how I'm seeing this. There isn't that much political difference here. We have different groups in Congress that, I guess, a little bit competing to who's going to take the lead. But as you mentioned, the National Cybersecurity Director, that could be something of a stepping stone that can actually consecrate this leadership onto how and where and when the United States is going to be pushing forward our national security front and cybersecurity. Is there anything else that you wish to tell us about this topic, to tell the audience, something that's very important that we should have?
Sure. Well, I'll start with a little story. I was actually personally affected, just like a number of Americans on the East Coast, affected by the Colonial Pipeline ransomware attack. I couldn't find a single gas station other than Costco to get gas. That was how bad it was on one of those days. It wasn't because of the fact that we didn't have enough gas. We didn't have enough gas distributed, right, and sent to the gas stations. And while it seems like a minor thing, it was a very regional attack, right? Like, it didn't affect other parts of the United States, affected mainly along the East Coast line, along that main pipeline that delivers that gasoline. Mm-hmm. But then I realized that if it can affect someone like myself, you know, at the time I was in DC or in the DC area, it can affect anybody, you know, and that it just happens to be that it happened to Colonial Pipeline. But Colonial Pipeline, SolarWinds, these name brands, they should not be the only ones. And I'm not defending every single thing that they've done, because obviously there's a conversation about that, but they should not be the labels that say, well, it's all on SolarWinds, or it's all on Colonial Pipeline, or it's all on, you know, I would even say just the foreign actors, because obviously the foreign actors, the malign powers that are doing all this stuff, or the non-state actors who are doing this, yes, they are the perpetrators, but we also need to be resilient and be vigilant for these attacks. It's also our responsibility too, to make sure that we do our best to have proper cyber hygiene, to encourage our lawmakers, even those who are in city council, you know, or those who are maybe a supervisor of some kind in your local area. Tell them about, if you're concerned about cyber and you want them to do more of it, absolutely, you have the capacity to do so. And so I just want to bring that message out to all of us here, that cyber really is changing a lot. We're learning more. Technology is rapidly changing every single time. It seems like every single day there's like a new technology that's being invented. That's kind of how fast we are now. But it doesn't have to remain that technical sense. And if the United States can change that narrative and include more individuals in cyber and realize that this is so much more than just a technical profession, in fact, it's actually a lifestyle, if we do it right, we'll be able to get to a much safer environment. And we also, if I just might add, you know, maybe cyber doesn't have to be just the only one constant growing. Maybe it's the fact that we can look at cyber differently, in the sense that we use cyber when we need to. We don't have to depend on it all the time. You know, in this day and age, obviously we've had a pandemic. We've had a lot of people work from home and everything, learn from home even. Let's also remind ourselves that when we put stuff in the internet, or we put stuff on our computer, it's not 100% safe. And maybe there's some things that we should be writing down, like physically with a pen and paper, you know, like that kind of thing. Maybe it's just having those personal conversations, meeting up with someone for coffee instead of just sticking with video calls, you know, especially with the vaccines being rolled out and everything. We need to think cyber a little bit differently here and realize that it doesn't have to engulf our lives. It's a major part of the way we live, and it's going to be even more so in the future, but it's not the end all be all. If we can have this sort of balance and have this particular lifestyle where we can be somewhat balanced, have our own personal balance of cyber and the non-cyber aspects of our lives. Overall, we could have perhaps a more satisfactory, more prosperous life that could really be so meaningful and something that we can cherish for many, many years to come.
Well, Sharon, thank you very much for that conclusion. You know what? Thank you very much for sharing your thoughts on cybersecurity, how that relates as a national security concern for the United States. I really appreciate you coming onto the show, and I really hope our audience enjoyed this talk.
Well, thank you so much, Sarah, for having me. And it was a pleasure to speak to you and the audience. And I really hope that this was of value to everyone. And I can't wait to see where these conversations go, because we're going to need everyone talking about it.
Thank you for listening to America's Moderate Voice. Please join us next time on our next discussion. And we now have a website. Look up Derek Gutierrez, American Identity, or simply search up the name of our podcast to join on our blogs. You may leave comments, ask questions, or simply engage in communal American policies. And also, look up my name on this new app called Clubhouse. Here, we will open up rooms to discuss what's going on in America. Whether it's foreign or domestic issues, come and join us in civil discussions. We're open to all points of views, as long as you respect each other's views. If you also want to support our podcast with a simple donation, you may click on the support link, the support podcast link on our episode's bio, or look up us on anchor.fm, that is ACHOR.FM, and to see our options on how you may support and contribute to our podcast. Your donations will help us grow our message and share the importance of our work. And please share your excitement of our podcast by spreading the word to all your friends and family, and to make this podcast a greater success. Remember to follow us on Instagram and Facebook at America's Moderate Voice for contact information and updates on our podcast.